Please the court, my name is David Porter, and I represent the appellant in this case, Michael Hansen. I'd reserve 3 minutes of time for rebuttal.
Okay.
The essence of the boiling everything down is that my client is asking that the petition be dismissed and costs and attorney fees be awarded. To begin with, I would stand on all of the arguments that are in the opening brief and the reply brief, and in respect that we're not going to be able to get to them all. In terms of the in-kind contribution, pursuant to a challenge finding in paragraph 3.7, the petitioner, Victoria, contributed $22,000 toward the purchase of the orchard property. This finding is challenged for at least three different reasons. One, substantial evidence in the record does not exist to support the challenge finding that Victoria actually contributed $22,000 in money toward the purchase of the orchard property.
Well, she testified that she did, right?
She testified that she did, but she also testified.
The judge apparently believed her?
Well, that's not the standard of review, though. The standard of review is that because this is a committed...
Well, it is. So we don't second-guess credibility determinations.
Yes, but she contradicted herself.
Her. It's the trial judge's province to believe witnesses or not believe witnesses. So the judge, she testified that it was so, and the judge believed her when she said it was so. Why isn't that substantial evidence that it is so?
Because she contradicted herself. She then testified that the $22,000 was an in-kind contribution. An in-kind contribution based on the fact that they were in this relationship and he had not been paying her any money in the context of the relationship, which is more like a business relationship than it is in terms of a committed intimate relationship.
Well, that's different. Now you're mixing up the questions. That they either had the relationship or they didn't.
Correct.
There's either evidence that they did or there wasn't. And then if there was evidence that they did have the necessary relationship, then we look at what the property interests are, the community-like property interests to be divided.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So your answer went from the second step back to the first step there, and I'm just trying to keep you on the second step.
Well, okay, so you're presuming that if there was a committed intimate relationship, then the court had the ability to determine the separate interests each party had in the property.
And the community-like interests, yes.
Well, community-like interest, I think that the court should be cautioned about the community-like interest in the respect that Pennington, which I believe is the case that's most on point in our particular case here, is because Connell and Lindsay were both stipulated to. In other words, they both stipulated that there was a committed intimate relationship. In Pennington, there was a dispute that there was a committed intimate relationship. So In Pennington, the court...
Well, is there a dispute that there was such a relationship, or is there just a dispute about when it ended?
There's a dispute whether or not there was a committed intimate relationship. It's our position that none of the five elements of Connell have been established in the case. And since the elements of Connell have not been established, then you can't even get to the issue of the parties' respective interests in the property. And as far as Pennington cautions the court to not look at things in terms of it being a marital-like relationship, in respect that it says the use of the term marital-like is a mere analogy, because defining meretricious relationships, which is a CIR, as related to marriage would create a de facto common law marriage, which the court has refused to do. So what Pennington has done is it has focused in on whether or not there's unjust enrichment.
But if we had a common law marriage, then the court would be able to distribute separate property in addition to community property, right?
We have no common law, so I don't know exactly what
the procedures
would be.
The purpose of a hypothetical
is
to ask a question about something that's somehow different from the fact that we have
I'm sorry.
So if we had a common law marriage, I know Washington doesn't allow it, but if we had a common law marriage, then the court would be able to distribute both community property and separate property, right? Just like a regular married by the preacher down by the river marriage, right?
Well, I don't
and
know.
So when we're being admonished not to not to fall into the danger of creating a common law marriage, really what we're being admonished to do is not to cross over that line away from community-like property.
No, that's not how I read it. How I read it is that, okay, the CIR is a judicially created cause of action to prevent unjust enrichment. Unjust enrichment is the reason that they, in other words, the Crispin presumption was set aside because of the case in Connell. And so what the court is looking for, and it's refined in the case of Pennington, is that the court is looking for any evidence of inequities which results in unjust enrichment. And so the court in Pennington is focusing on unjust enrichment as opposed to the other aspects of the case, which is also...
How does unjust enrichment manifest itself?
It manifests itself by showing that one party put... Okay, so the Pennington, I think it's 605, that the petitioner must show that she has put continuous or constant payments into a major asset, or that there's been, to paraphrase, sweat equity put into an asset. And then if those two conditions exist, as stated in Pennington, I think it was 605, then there can be a showing that if the other party is awarded the property, we're talking about major assets here, if the other party is awarded the property, then the there's been a showing, there has to be a showing of unjust enrichment in terms of, okay, I put sweat equity into the property. Well, in this particular case, the orchard property remains undeveloped. And since it's undeveloped, there's no sweat equity in there. And she also testified that she had no evidence that she put any funds into the purchase of the orchard property.
Well, very few, there was very little evidence about any transfers of funds with this couple who bury cash in jars in the backyard. I mean, this was not a typical, from either side was this typical of an evidentiary submissions on their accumulation of wealth.
But I think Pennington is requiring the petitioner to prove that she put substantial investment of time and effort into an asset, or she it's up to her to prove that she put money into the asset itself. So.
Good morning. May it please the court. Catherine Berger on behalf of Victoria Hostetter, the appellant. The respondent in this case. Judge Snyder is an extremely experienced Superior Court judge. In asking the court to support or to affirm his decision, we're asking the court to defer to his findings. He viewed all the evidence. He heard all the testimony. He actually took extra time to review the evidence, 2 extra weeks before he rendered his decision. His decision was supported by substantial evidence. Thank you.
Did you wish to make any additional argument, or is...
Well, I'll speak... the one that just jumped out is the in-kind contribution, but that's just a misreading of the transcript. And that is, Victoria testified that she contributed $22,000. And then she testified the rest of it was in-kind. The property was placed in her name. And she took that to be a gift, the balance of it to be a gift to her, from Mike, just to let her know that he appreciated everything she had contributed to building the cabin and all the work she'd done to build the cabin. So that's simply a misreading of the transcript, and that it's clear on page 48, which is where Victoria testifies that the in-kind contribution was for the balance of the value of the orchard. If I were going to comment on anything else, I think the question of the statute of limitations, there's the one issue that's a little sticky, and that is Judge Snyder found this window of time in which the relationship terminated. and the appellant suggested that the termination date should be like a threshold issue, like you find in a substantial change in circumstances for a child support modification or for a parenting plan modification. Those are statutory thresholds. But contracts don't have thresholds. They have facts. Facts, when was it created, when was it terminated, who didn't do what. They have facts, not thresholds. And in this case, the judge looked at the facts of the relationship and determined that this relationship terminated within this window of time. When it comes to...
Well, and the window of time, though, is the statutory time period. So there is a statute of limitations.
Yes, correct. And he found clearly that the statute of limitations, if that occurred after the statute of limitations would have applied. That was his finding.
Well, he found that it terminated at some point within 3 years of the filing of the petition. That's what he found. That the first pleading was filed within 3 years of the date that it determined, even though he didn't give a specific date that it terminated. That was his finding.
Yes, right? He did find.
Okay, so what is the purpose of trying to determine when a committed intimate relationship ends?
Well,
why do we care?
We care, one, because if it affects a right or a responsibility, then a date could matter, a specific date could matter.
I mean, the reason we care is because only by knowing when it begins and when it ends can we determine what property is there to be distributed, right? Isn't that
Correct.
Really what it's all about?
Correct.
And so as long as there's a finding that's specific enough to identify what property was held, then if we know it began and we know it was a relationship that qualifies, we don't need anything more than that for an end date, as long as we know that it ended later than the last of this property that's being asked to be distributed was acquired, right? Isn't that what it's all about?
That's correct.
Simple as that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And that is, I think that's well within the court's discretion if it looks at the facts and says this happened within this window, that it happened within that window. It doesn't need a specific date. Thank you.
Thank you.
Minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. The termination date of the committed intimate relationship is important for two things. Number one, it's important for purposes of the five legs of the stool, so to speak, of the Connell requirements. In other words, there's five factors of Connell, and one of the factors is the duration of the committed intimate relationship. So in order to even get to the division of property, first you have to determine, you know, those five elements of Connell, one of which is the duration.
Do you need to have a specific date? I mean, does it have to be duration down to the particular date?
I believe so, yes.
Why?
And the reason I believe so...
It's an equitable doctrine. Why would that be?
I believe so because when you're looking at Kelly, for example, Kelly talks about the ability to file your lawsuit. In other words, when the relationship terminates, that's when the three-year statute of limitations happens.
Yeah, but that statute of limitation affirmative defense has nothing to do with whether or not a relationship exists. Why would specificity with regard to when a relationship that otherwise is shown to have existed, ended, matter? Why would it matter whether it was on June 16th or June 17th?
Well, I guess it matters in the respect that there was no determination as to when it occurred.
It matters so that we know what's subject to division, right?
Well, in...
Or distribution.
Yeah, but it matters in that respect, but it also matters in terms of the duration.
Whatever facts are being relied on to prove the existence of relationship at least occurred within that time, even if the later time is an approximation. Was there any evidence or was there any dispute as to whether any property that was distributed was acquired between the date that your client testified it ended and the date that Judge Snyder found that it ended, the time period that Judge Snyder found that it ended?
I believe that
everything was acquired before your before the date that your client put forward, right?
Correct.
Okay. Was the existence of the relationship itself dependent on any existence of the relationship, not its duration, the existence dependent on any facts that occurred after the date that your client testified the relationship had ended?
Well, we're talking about continuous cohabitation, and continuous cohabitation requires that the parties reside together. In terms of the Division II case, that cohabitation is a sine qua non of a committed intimate relationship.
But they had cohabited before. They either cohabited or not before the date that your client identified as its termination date, right?
They cohabited until 2006. My client stated that. Well, he stated a couple of different times. One time he said it terminated in 2006, and another time he stated it terminated
when he got back from Europe.
I'm sorry?
We're done. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Next up is Nelson versus